Good morning, New Mexico. Welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company, streaming on the web at KSFR.org, podcasting at SantaFeRadioCafe.org, thanks to Dotfoil Computer Services, and we're at Facebook.com/Radio Cafe. I'm delighted now to welcome poets Tommy Archuleta and Dana Levin. They are coordinators of the Muse Times 2 poetry series at Collected Works Bookstore, which starts this coming Friday at 6 in the evening. And we're talking to John Wilkins, who is an award-winning poet. He won the Aga Shahid Ali Prize in Poetry, and he's the author of the new book, Transistor Rodeo, and he is part of the first Muse Times 2 poetry series. He's also a professor at the Santa Fe Institute. Welcome.
Hi.
Hi there.
So this is a series of poetry that goes really the whole academic year, starting now and going through next May. What's the genesis of this series? How did it come together, and what's the idea of it?
I'm currently a MFA candidate at the University of New Mexico, going for my Master's of Fine Arts in Poetry, and part of the coursework, some of us get to build and construct independent studies. And so, being that Dana and I are good friends and she's my mentor, she told me last summer of a conversation she had with Dorothy, who's the owner and operator of Collected Works, and was presented with this idea of having a series. And so that morphed into making and, you know, molding it into a independent study. And that's built around organizing and coordinating a series. And so, you know.
What's the idea of the series? How did you choose the particular poets who are coming?
Well, Dana, by the way, is like helping me steer this whole thing. I couldn't do it without her. But she had a lot of friends that are writing that aren't necessarily well known, but they're on the cusp of that, and they're scattered around the nation. Not all of them are academic poets. Most of them are.
Academic poets?
Yeah, they teach. You know, the poets that teach, and have either a tenured position somewhere, and so. Some of them happened. I had my favorites, and she had her recommendations, and organizing it all at the beginning was quite the task.
Yeah, the poets are coming. The headline poets are coming from New York City, from Michigan, from Seattle, from Houston, and Tommy in particular felt really invested in pairing them up with local writers. And one of the things about the local poets that are going to be reading in the series is there's lots of people who are doing great poetry writing in Santa Fe, and we wanted to see if we could focus on people that the community might not even know was writing, like John Wilkins, for instance, whose book just won a first prize. And there's a guy named Jamie Ross who lives off the grid in Taos who just won a book prize. He's going to be reading for us in April. We're going to bring up Amy Beater, who's a great, well-published poet who lives in Albuquerque. So we kind of wanted to mix up the quote-unquote local scene in terms of who we brought to read as part of this, and wanting to hook the local poet up with the person from out of town to sort of maximize audience if possible. So, and these are they're all really great writers. A lot of them are emerging writers with one book, or they've been writing for a while, but they're not as high on the radar as I at least would want them to be. So
this coming Friday at 6 o'clock at Collected Works Bookstore, John Wilkins, who is here with us, and Ed Skoog, who is not here with us due to the fact that I didn't get it together to contact him in time, will be reading. Ed Skoog from out of town. How did you, Tommy, how did you pick Ed?
Ed is a Copper Canyon Press poet. Copper Canyon is a publisher that's pretty much devoted to putting out poets, and I keep my eye on that press, and I ran into Ed's work through a little kind of circular that Copper Canyon puts out, where they give you a portion of the work and there's a little aesthetic statement by the poet. And from that, I looked into his work and found some of the poems from this his most current collection. The reason I picked him is mostly due to one of the other motives of this series is to kind of give people glimpses of both sides of the what might be the two main streams in contemporary poetry, which is lyric and narrative. And to me, Skoog
could you explain those?
Yeah, well, narrative basically in terms of poems that tell a story, they move linearly. They have what might be called a narrative arc, an Aristotelian beginning, middle, and end.
Or just a regular old
beginning, middle, and end. They just tell a story, and there's a speaker, and it's really, you know, you're located, you know what's going on. And lyric poetry really doesn't really operate on a plot basis. It moves in an entirely different way.
Like a song.
It can move like a song, but it can be a meditation on one object, and it can drift from the present moment to some point in time or into the future. So to me, Ed is one of those guys that has one foot in the narrative school and one foot in the lyric school. And he is also a personal poet in that he brings personal experience, and his work is infected by it. So those were some of the reasons why I chose him.
Yeah, I just wanted to add that I think Tommy might agree with me too that some of the most interesting contemporary poetry being written today is usually working both lyric and narrative modes in a single poem. So you think it's a narrative poem, but in fact it's a single meditation. It starts out as a meditation. In fact, it's telling a story and sort of blurring those lines.
John Wilkins, where do you stand when you contemplate those two categories and thinking about your own work?
I mean, I think mine probably errs on the side of lyric to a certain extent.
If error is to be.
Yeah. Because, you know, to me, that's the thing in some ways that's special about poetry, right? That, you know, you can write narrative poetry, you can also write a narrative newspaper article.
And you can
it's
also
very
write
hard
a
to write a lyric
story.
Newspaper article, right?
Yeah.
Yes, yeah. And, you know, that to me, you know, back even, you know, in junior high school, that was the thing that drew me to poetry. It was reading things like, you know, Byron, who would say things like, I fall upon the thorns of life, I bleed. It's like, wow, there's some art form where you can say that.
Yeah, right.
And you
we're
can
not
mean
getting
it.
That from the newspaper.
And you don't get that from the newspaper so much.
Or from TV or much of anything else.
No. You do get it from Fox News.
Oh, well, there you go.
And that's a whole other conversation. Let's hear, we want to hear some poetry by John Wilkins in a moment. Let's also hear from Dana reading a piece from Mr. Skylight by Ed Skoog.
Yeah, Ed is in Seattle. That's where he lives. He's not getting into town until Friday. Mr. Skylight is a phrase that is an emergency signal to alert a ship's crew, but not its passengers, of an emergency. So it's a very, it's not just a whimsical title. And Ed worked in New Orleans for a while, and there are a lot of poems in here that seem to respond to Katrina. He's also lived in Southern California, so there are poems that respond to wildfires. But I'm just going to read from the first section of Mr. Skylight, which is a long poem. Mr. Skylight, when you enter the city of riots, confess what turns your life has taken, what is hard on and what is mineral. Confess until the wind catches itself by the tail. Or find some solace. Mr. Skylight captains a houseboat downstream like a vitamin. I can only just begin to bear the chain link fence. Reflected in a puddle, the image trembles as I tremble. The image freezes. I shiver. It is like the enormity Gregor Samsa is hoping to sleep through, but, well, can't. The woman playing Atari in public has everything's hauled away. In buckets. These peaches, for example, I have heard of you, yes, the monkey says. The moon offers its offensive and ridiculous bulge.
So that's just a taste of what we might hear from Ed Skoog this Friday at Collected Works Bookstore. You have a peach poem, John Wilkins.
I do have a peach poem.
Do you want to read it?
I would be happy to.
I love peaches.
I love peaches too, especially this time of year.
Oh, yeah.
This poem, while I find it here, is part of a sequence of poems where each one has a title that's a time and then a couple of objects and slash prayer. And the idea is that it starts as a meditation at a particular time, sort of inspired by a surrounding. And then
so
that meditation leads to a prayer.
So I was wondering whether you were sitting at your desk at this, you are among other things a professor at the Santa Fe Institute, whether you're sitting at your desk at the Institute, stopping thinking about evolutionary theory for a few minutes and writing these pieces.
I actually find I can't switch back and forth that quickly, because otherwise you wind up with very clinical, over-explainy sort of poems.
Right.
Because I think, you know, that's one of the goals with writing about science is you want to say, well, here's an idea. And even if you're writing for a professional audience, you know, hopefully you're trying to do something new, which means that you want to make the idea as accessible and transparent and clear as possible. And in a way, with poetry, if you follow that same impulse too strongly, you sort of squeeze all the life and complexity out of a poem.
Well, let's hear this. Okay. Read us the title again.
It's 10:25 p.m., wicker basket, mechanical pencil, prayer. Behind this door you will find the most princely of peaches. Childlike in its sincerity, it stands tall like a stripe on Flag Day. If you were crossing the highway, this peach would run you down like a nun. This peach is a bullet in a hurricane hopped up on rocket fuel. Run, little man, try to hide from this peach. This peach lives for the feel of the wind in its hair and can't wait for cider season. This peach should have a corner office. You'd be lucky to be this peach, little man. You were wrong about me, God. You were wrong about the pieces in my brain, how you thought your pornography could distract me. You may be angry, God, but you are far away. And I am naked and luscious like the moon, and so full of acts that none of them may ever escape. Now grant me powers to see beyond my keys and that horizon. Grant me that, and I will promise you anything.
John Wilkins. So I have to ask you, I read that poem multiple times and thought, what's the peach?
Yeah, I don't really have a good answer for that. it's one of these things I know what I was sort of imagining and thinking of when I was writing it, but at some level, at least for me, one of the goals in this is to, you want to take your experience and sort of the emotion and sensation around a particular experience and translate it into something that will hopefully connect to someone else's experience, but in a way that your experience may be completely different, right? So, this in particular is in a lot of ways inspired by, you know, a friend of mine. And it's more sort of the emotional content of who he is as a person is really what was, what inspired the meditation part of that poem.
Right. Well, it does lead to a conversation that I was just having with Dana and Tommy before we got on the air, which is that sometimes for me, reading poetry, and I relive the experience that I had in high school where you have to read, you have your homework. You go home, you read these poems by, let's say, romantic poets or whatever. You don't understand anything. Then you go into school and you go through this whole process with the teacher and you kind of, through a combination of learning to analyze the poem and learning biographical details about the poet and the time and the situation, all of that stuff, you learn what the heck the thing means. And then for me, at the age of 14 or 15, I'm going, well, why couldn't you just said that?
Well, you know, the thing about poetry and public education that is sometimes so frustrating is I don't know if all teachers know how to teach poetry, because I think poetry is a very different animal than prose. And all of the ways in which we're trained to read, i.e. to suss out meaning, to make sense, are things that poetry is often subverting or skirting around. And so to teach elementary school kids, high school kids, to encounter a poem as if it's some obscure thing that you can extract some clarity from is actually, in some ways, the worst way to approach a poem. I think that participation in a poem, well, first of all, I think a poem requires a lot of participation from its reader. And I think what John was saying about how, you know, his idea for the poem is could have bear no relationship to your reception of the poem as you read it, and that your reception has validity. I think what can be so frustrating for teaching poetry in elementary school and high school, and also for reading it as a student, is that in fact there is no right answer. So much of it has to do with sort of privileging and validating the worth of subjective experience. It's really different from having a science mind, yeah?
Yeah.
So I mean, that's my little criticism of how poetry's dealt with outside of college. At the same time, I do think that, at least when I deal with my students, I think you have to personally, if you're a poet, you have to personally wrestle with what is your relationship to an audience going to be? Do you care about them? Do you not care about them? Do you want to connect with your audience really easily? Do you want your audience to have to work a little hard? My old colleague from College of Santa Fe, Greg Glazner, used to make a great cogent defense of complicated poetry by saying life is complex. Being a human being is complex. Why should we expect art to give us clarity when there is no clarity
in life
or in the mind or in the world? And at the same time, you know, and for me, in my own writing, it changes from poem to poem. Sometimes I'm working on a poem and I really want this poem to be available with minimum work. Other times I'm working on a poem where it doesn't matter to me. Or it's more about the surfaceness of just wielding language, you know, of just the weirdness of saying, you know, here's a line from Ed. I'll return to car, wheel baby across the difficult tracks. The ice in my soda barely melted. That's actually really available. But I mean, just, you know, saying anything that might be kind of weird. Anyway.
I haven't been writing since, you know, like a lot of poets, like I didn't start writing as a child.
How did you start?
I came recently to it, and it's only in 2009 that I actually graduated from and did my undergrad degree. And so I didn't really start till 2002. I've been playing drums for over almost 30 years now. So when I started to encounter this art form, I was pretty much taken aback that I'd never seen language operating at this level. My association with language had always been gleaning information from newspapers or whatnot. And my relationship to language is probably no different than my relationship to my friends. They're always there and it's easy to take them for granted. So when I started experiencing language operating at this level, the first thing I had to ask myself was, why in the hell are the lines so damn short? Why don't they go all the way to the other end of the page? And then that's when I started to realize, oh, it's really one of the first things here is really about the musicality of the language. And I didn't really started to notice that even, I think Pinsky's right, I think we sing to each other every day because each word has an accented and an unaccented syllables. So at that ground level, I started to really embrace language in a new way. So and so content, John used the word err, you know, anymore I err on the side of accessibility, because accessibility to my mind and difficulty is an age ancient discussion and debate in art in all forms. How available do I want to make the art? How much of it is going to remain private? How much personal information can be obtained and accessible? And so I'm pretty much more interested in what people are going to put to my poems or the songs I write. My job is just to crank it out and make it as open as many doors as I can. I'm not interested in you knowing what I mean by X poem or X song, actually. If I was, I'd probably be teaching poetry professionally, because then I would be more interested in trying to focus in on what's important about so-and-so's movement or so-and-so's poem. I'm more interested about the activity of imagination and creativity at work. So when I teach poems, I try to concentrate on students, what's working with their poems, and try to actually give them suggestions about how they might take their poem in another direction. I'm not really in the business of telling them where it's not working at all. A lot of that has to do with my training at College of Santa Fe with Dana and Greg and Matt Donovan and all those people who are all publishing poets and working poets. And so it was, I blame them for my point of view, you know. But the contemporary poetry that's happening right now, the poetry of the moment, I think Tony Hoagland is one that writes very, very well about what's not happening in poetry right now. And part of it, he talks about what he calls a skittery poem, which is really a poem that is, craft-wise, it's amazing. I mean, it's beautifully written. The language is operating at a wondrous level, and it's being